Good afternoon. I'm Nadine Hansen. This is session number 165, The God of This World, Gnostic Insights into Mormonism. I would like to remind all of you to please turn off any cell phones or pagers. If you have any other noise-making devices, please turn them off. We will soon hear from our presenters, and then at the conclusion of their remarks, we'll have some comments. We'll have probably have some time for comments from the audience, and at that time, I'll ask you to use the microphone. Scott Smith is a freelance journalist with nearly 900 articles published in a variety of publications, including the Christian Science Monitor, Reader's Digest, AARP, and some lesser-known publications such as Soldier of Fortune, Psychic World, and UFO Magazine. He is the author of The Soul of Your Pet, Evidence for the Survival of Animals After Death, and the forthcoming Conquering Cancer Naturally. He served an LDS mission in Central Germany and was the director of Progress, an association of LDS Democrats. He was a frequent guest lecturer at UCLA and Cal State Northridge on the Mormon theory of American Indian origins. He presented four papers at Sunstone Symposia in 1990, and none since then? None since then. Well, we're glad to have you back. He is now a member of Ecclesia Gnostica in Los Angeles. The respondent, Maxine Hanks, is certainly very well known at Sunstone. She's a writer, a lecturer, a feminist author. She literally wrote the book on reemerging Mormon feminism. And she recently completed a semester as a fellow at Harvard Divinity School. And she what do you call yourself at the Gnostic? Yeah, she's clergy at the local Gnostic congregation. I have been to one of her services. I'm sure this will be a really interesting panel. I'm a real Dan Brown fan, so I'll be interested in hearing everyone's insights. Scott.
Can you hear me in the back? Okay. Before I get rolling here, let me give my email address out because I don't want you to have to write down some books you might want to look up. And if you just send me a note, I will send you back the censored version of this presentation after I hear what Maxine has to say. And it's SSSMITH, the number 2, at Adelphia, ADELPHIA.net. And if you didn't get that, come up afterwards. I can give you one of my cards with my email address on it. Is God good? All religions except Gnosticism assume the answer is yes, all evidence to the contrary for the God of this world. That phrase is a title designating Satan in the temple endowment. In Gnostic theology, however, this would refer to the creator and ruler of this world, a powerful malefic being called the Demiurge, which means craftsman or half-maker, referring to his ability to work only with matter, not to create spirits. The idea that the creator of this world is evil is the ultimate heresy, worse than atheism in the eyes of the Orthodox. It is also the one topic that no one wants to think about. In the next half hour, I can only barely skim the subject to stimulate a conversation. So, as Betty Davis said in All About Eve, fasten your seatbelts, it's going to be a bumpy ride. Of course, everything I say is strictly my opinion and doesn't have anything to do with anybody else's idea of what Gnosticism or Mormonism is. In January 1989, while seeking a renewed testimony of the Book of Mormon at a time of doubt, I had a mystical experience that I did not fully understand at the time, but which shocked me into questioning the fundamental beliefs of all religions. And my immediate reaction to that was to become more active, hence the four papers I gave at Sunstone the following year. But it took me 16 years to understand that it was an encounter with Gnosticism, and the experience lifted the veil from my eyes as far as the meaning of life goes. While the concept of an evil creator is the greatest stumbling block to accepting Gnosticism, I believe it provides at least a partial solution to the problem of evil in a world in which other religions assert God is in complete control. As C.G. Jung, the great psychologist who was important in reviving interest in Gnosticism, said, only the Gnostics take evil seriously. I saw a bumper sticker the other day that read, if you're not completely appalled, you haven't been paying attention. And that is my message here. And I can assure you that I am an optimist by nature, so I'm not overstating the case that I'm going to go into now. It's clearly best to construct a theology around reality rather than ignoring unpleasant facts. However, it is quite possible to accept the concept of an evil creator and still have a life full of happiness and joy. And I personally have a terrific career, a great personal life, and I have answers to prayers and miracles in my life, even with this changed perspective on who's in control of the world. And Gnostics are optimistic about the long-term fate of all spirits. Gnosticism was a diverse Christian movement that grew out of the combination of Jewish esotericism, Platonic philosophy, personal mystical experience, and what it claimed were the true teachings of Jesus in public and private, passed on especially from Mary Magdalene, who is depicted in Gnostic scriptures as Jesus' closest companion, and the apostles Philip and Paul. As Richard Smalley notes in Forbidden Faith, the Gospel of Thomas may have been written as early as 50 AD before the four canonical Gospels. The first of the major early church fathers, Justin Martyr, never referred to the canonical Gospels. And the existence of the Acts of the Apostles, or of Acts, wasn't revealed until the anti-Gnostic Bishop Irenaeus presented a copy in the mid-second century. Some other Gnostic teachers claim to have received their teachings from companions of the Apostle Paul, which seems surprising given that he is considered the founder of Orthodox Christianity. But as Timothy Frake and Peter Gandy argue in The Laughing Jesus, the alleged writings of Paul that have some of his most Orthodox and anti-female views are the most suspect as forgeries. By the time of Irenaeus, Gnostics, quote, filled the whole universe, according to the early church fathers and pagan philosophers. One of his contemporaries, the great Gnostic teacher Valentinus, actually came within a narrow vote to becoming the Bishop of Rome, which was not the papacy at the time, but was very influential. The first Christian state, Edessa in Syria, was Gnostic. While the Orthodox Church eventually beat back this movement that was its greatest threat, Gnosticism did become a worldwide religion in the form of Manichaeism, which was founded by the Persian prophet Mani, and it flourished from the 3rd century to the 10th century. The last Gnostic organizations were the Cathars in France in the 12th century and the Knights Templar in the 13th and 14th, and both of which were severely persecuted by the Catholic Church. There were two beliefs among the theologically diverse Gnostics that were most widely shared. One was in gnosis, the mystical insight that one is connected with God, liberating the experiencer from attachment to the world. Harold Bloom, in The American Religion, argued that Mormonism was a form of Gnosticism because of its emphasis on personal revelation and spiritual gifts, and its teaching that we are gods in embryo. However, since personal illumination of whatever type is only satisfying for the one who receives it, and revelation seem to affirm contradictory ideas, this presents a major barrier for anyone outside of the experiencer to evaluate this in the search for truth. But the second most common belief among Gnostics in the Demiurge does provide what I believe ought to be the starting point for assessing whether a particular religion describes the meaning of this life in a way that stands up to scrutiny. Gnostics identified the Demiurge with the Old Testament Jehovah and asserted that he denied the existence of the true and transcendent God. Says Stefan Heller in his modern classic Gnosticism, New Light on the Ancient Tradition of Inner Knowing, which I regard as the best introduction to Gnosticism, ancient and modern. Some Gnostics today would say that the Demiurge is a Jungian archetype or part of the structure of the mind. My personal belief is that it is a malevolent and twisted supernatural intelligence, but none of these viewpoints are mutually exclusive. The LDS doctrine that embodiment is an essential first step on the path of eternal progression is the opposite of the Gnostic view of mortality as a prison. Since the Gnostic starting point for their argument was the Old Testament, let's see who has the better case and what it tells us about the Creator. And then we'll see whether the purpose of creation as supposedly explained to us in the pre-existence makes coherent sense. At the end of the sixth day, the Bible says, God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. Now, one can quibble whether this was the spiritual creation, but obviously the Creator thought that what he had done was good. From the standpoint of the inconceivable numbers of dinosaurs, insects, mammals, and other animals which had suffered and died over the past 600 million years, the creation has been a very bad idea. For those who doubt that animals can suffer to a very refined degree, I commend the evidence in When Elephants Weep by Jeffrey Mason and Susan McCarthy. Evolution has also been extraordinarily inefficient and unintelligently designed and directed, belying the Creator's claim to being all-powerful and perfect. Jehovah acts angry and surprised when his handiwork Adam and Eve sin so seriously that he feels their descendants need to be cursed forever with hard work and painful childbirth. Later, he would curse the descendants of evildoers to the fourth generation, an odd sense of justice. The Old Testament patriarchs and prophets presumably had no knowledge of the true prehistory of the world, but they did see the immense suffering of humans and animals around them due to incurable diseases, natural disasters, famines, war, torture, and cruelty that Jehovah had to know would be part of the world when it was created. But somehow, evil and suffering are never his fault, even when the Bible has him endorsing genocide or slavery or wiping out every living thing with a flood. While the Gentile world was supposedly being ignored by God, the tiny nation of Israel was given 613 regulations that required Moses to spend 40 days on Mount Sinai to get the details right about the design of the Ark of the Covenant, the dress of the priests, the rules for treating women as unclean, stoning to death for children who insulted their parents, and the mass sacrifice of animals that was to be the centerpiece of Jewish worship for over a millennium. Somehow, though, God forgot to make clear what would happen after death. The book of Judges has been summarized by Jonathan Kirsch in The Harlot by the Side of the Road as consisting of, quote, the oddest assortment of rogues, outlaws, and lowlifes in all of the Bible. Seducers and harlots, assassins and mercenaries, rapists and torturers. And much of this was apparently with Jehovah's approval. Kenneth Davis, author of Don't Know Much About the Bible, gives an R rating to the Songs of Solomon. If it were published today, the church would advise members not to read it, rather than pretending it is a spiritual allegory. God's selection of the first kings of Israel was disastrous. Saul, David, and Solomon were liars, mass murderers, and adulterers, and sponsored pagan worship, but all the while staying in touch with Jehovah and receiving revelation. The writers of Chronicles realized they needed to censor these details in their retelling, but added to the many contradictions in the Bible in the process. Latter-day Saints agree that the Bible is imperfect in order to justify modern scripture, but they want to have it both ways by taking every story in the Old Testament literally. Apparently, God could part the Red Sea, but could not communicate with the Bible's writers and editors. As Davis says, one can best describe the God of the Old Testament as boastful, insecure, jealous, capricious, testy, impatient, and inconsistently forgiving and compassionate. The wisdom that can be found in the Old Testament does not cancel out the fact that many of those who have accepted it as scripture have believed that it justified horrendous things. This is true even if the genocide of the Canaanites did not actually happen the way the Bible says it did, which is the argument of some archaeologists. One might add here that the book of Revelation is the one part of the New Testament that is consistent with the Old and is out of harmony with Jesus' primary message. If one did not come to it knowing that it had two millennia of Christian acceptance, one would dismiss it as something written by an apocalyptic sect which delighted in the idea that the world would be filled with other people's blood. While Doctrine and Covenants 77 affirms the literalness of Revelation, it also says the earth has been around for 7,000 years. Because the Old Testament depiction of God seems so out of harmony with Christ's teachings, the second century Gnostic leader and one-time bishop, Marcion, compiled the first version of the Christian Bible, which consisted of an edited version of Luke and 9 of Paul's epistles. It was in reaction to this that the Orthodox Church began compiling its own canon. As Boyd Kirtland documented in The Development of the Mormon Concept of God, published in Line Upon Line, between 1833 and 1916, most Mormons distinguished between Jehovah as God the Father and Jesus, and the latter was not included among the creator gods in the temple endowment. Never mind what the Book of Mormon and early sections of the DNC implied. Brigham Young said, if the scriptures contradicted his theology, then it was because the scriptures were, quote, baby stories, unquote, that were given to people who weren't spiritually ready. So let us for the moment set aside the LDS investment in the Old Testament as literally true on every point. And let's go back to the pre-existence arguments for the need for a material creation. According to Mormon doctrine, God the Father provided some of the co-eternal but less developed spirit intelligences with greater capabilities than they innately had. Since God is said to have been following what had been done by other gods before him, he would have had to have been aware of the portion of spirits who would be more likely to do evil than good on the material plane. He would therefore bear much responsibility for the results that followed. Latter-day Saints believe that God proposed a plan for coming to earth that would allow each spirit to develop free will and the chance to become a god. Jesus is said to have offered to become mortal and to suffer in our stead for our inevitable sins, enabling us to be forgiven. Lucifer objected that this plan would mean that most spirits would not return to God's presence and proposed that he be allowed to force everyone to do good. We are told that because he wanted the glory for saving all souls and rebelled against God's plan, he was cast out of heaven permanently along with one-third of our brothers and sisters who sided with him. Given the eternal precedence according to LDS doctrine, one has to assume that God knew that a large portion of spirits would rebel against such a plan. One estimate of the number of people born throughout history is 70 billion. And if we assume that either the second coming, global warming, or biological or nuclear terrorism will bring an end to the world in the next few decades, that means we started out with the plan of salvation taking off 35 billion people off the table as far as the purpose of creation goes. Let's add to that those who have died before 8, for whom Mormon tradition says earth life is essentially irrelevant. And why not expand that to include everyone who died before 25 who didn't really have much earthly experience? So a conservative estimate based on ancient infant mortality and demographic figures would be 30% or 21 billion. So before we really have much experience to draw on in the world, we're missing half of those who were given this choice in the pre-existence. And the Creator had to know in advance that this would happen if one believes that he is omniscient. Jared Diamond's masterfully documented Guns, Germs, and Steel gives one the impression that the vast majority of humans who lived a longer life would have been able to do much more than barely survive. There's been an utterly absurd level of natural catastrophes or plagues against which there has been little defense. One might also ask why the intensity of pain is so many times greater than necessary to teach appropriate lessons. How about half as intense? That would seem to do the purpose quite well. I don't believe that there is any grand spiritual lessons to be learned that can be correlated with the amount of suffering that's involved in something like long-term cancer. Nor did God allow anesthesia to be discovered early, nor most cures for many dreadful diseases. It's as if the Creator sadistically tried to hide the truth about anything that would alleviate suffering. The sort of Creator we're describing would also be consistent with one that knew that this material world would yield many who would become Attila the Hun, Genghis Khan, Hitler, Stalin, and Mao, in order to supposedly enable a small number to return to the celestial kingdom. The plan for mortality appears to be designed to produce devils, not gods. And Mormonism's extreme optimism about human nature seems rooted in the ivory tower of America's 19th century. As for the importance of finding the saving truth in this life, Christianity has the bizarre notion that the only ones who can be saved are those who accept Christ as Savior, condemning most people to hell for nothing more than being born in the wrong millennium, which sounds like a God who is actually the devil to me. Mormons kick this problem into the hereafter, saying that everyone who didn't have a fair chance to accept the gospel here will get it over there. Yet we're told that people don't change greatly from this life, and in any event, only a small number of people are going to make it into the celestial kingdom. The terrestrial and telestial kingdoms are supposedly not so bad, but those were not the goals for which we are said to have been willing to risk so much suffering and the possibility of not coming back at all. If the position that everything gets adjusted after death is true, then it's all the more to the point that this earth life can't be what we were told it was really for. And this also begs the question, why should the average historic adult lifespan of around 45 years for those who survive childhood have an eternal impact on our spiritual state? After all, one third of our lives is taken up with sleep, and the rest either in distracting recreations or learning skills that have little application in the next life, no matter what Mormon tradition is about gaining knowledge from this life. Clearly, nobody's getting a degree in planet management, so the skills of a god would have to be magically bestowed. And no one can argue that there are large numbers of members of the church who are so righteous that they are a few steps away from godhood. So all these skills and knowledge would have to be developed for a long time in the hereafter, dwarfing their earthly time. Given how terribly the Creator's plan worked out for most people, why would anyone want to model it when they become a god anyway? I don't even know anyone who would want the cosmic version of Big Love. Who would want to perpetuate on their spirit children Alzheimer's, genetic deformities, bubonic plague, schizophrenia, child molestation, drug addiction, fascism, suicidal depression, tsunamis, rape, and mass starvation, just so the cycle of allowing a few people to become gods can be repeated? All of this raises a fundamental question about the plan of salvation as it was supposedly presented in the pre-existence. How could we have made any kind of informed decision about what embodiment would really entail? Whatever we were told, it was supposedly enough to scare off one third of us into risking eternal damnation by rebelling against it. Furthermore, how much real free will do we have? Anyone in psychiatry or psychotherapy knows that we are largely puppets of our genetics, physical environment, and childhood influences, so that few people are able to escape that programming unless they do a lot of guided personal work. And almost everybody has some neurosis or obsession, which Mormons are very adept at hiding from themselves and others under a whirlwind of activity. As Cordelia Fine points out in A Mind of Its Own, the brain has a powerful penchant for self-delusion. Add to this the hundreds of psychiatric illnesses, and human beings are all just crazy to varying degrees, which is not a good start for exercising free will. And all of these impact our relationships. Harville Hendricks explains in Getting the Love You Want that creating good ones requires extraordinary effort, and most people are doomed by the fairy tales that Hollywood tells about love, the biochemistry of infatuation, and the enormous challenges of imperfect people trying to get along. As quantum physics suggests, it isn't freedom that predominates in the universe, but randomness, and the only way to predict what will happen is to exercise control over events, which interferes with freedom. After spending much of the time since I was last here in 1990 thinking about free will and these things through this prism, I believe that it is a powerful counter-argument to the notion that the God of this world is an all-powerful being and that everything fits into this benevolent master plan. Fundamentalists try to get around this by asserting that God is merely all-knowing, that he isn't forcing us to do anything. But as Kent Robeson pointed out in Line Upon Line, you can't argue that we are free in any real way if every single thing we do is 100% predictable. Although I believe that our spirits existed before this life, the official LDS story about why we came into mortality cannot possibly be entirely true. It would, however, make perfect sense, either as a feel-good fairy tale to keep us docile, or an inspiring mythology to give us hope, or both, since Gnostics believe that the true God can turn the demiurge's work to higher purposes. While some Gnostic-related philosophies have their own mystical way of explaining evil without invoking the demiurge, in my opinion, every other theological issue is irrelevant if one does not recognize that the God of this world is not the good being that religions teach. Can one accept that and still call oneself a Mormon? It would be easy for Gnostics to take the position that because Mormonism sees earth life as essential, believes in physical resurrection, accepts the Old Testament as scripture, and is patriarchal, it is among the tools of the demiurge. But I think it is a reasonable position to assess the fruits of Mormonism as good and to believe that it was an effort by the spirit world to reform mainstream Christianity. Its appeal is certainly understandable. As Dr. Gerald Jones articulated in the last symposium, it's possible to be intellectual and enjoy the community of the saints. I believe Joseph Smith was visited by heavenly messengers, that members of the LDS Church received personal revelation about the truth of the Book of Mormon. I believe that one can make a credible case for at least its core story being historical for a small group of people. I know that LDS prayers are answered and that members perform miraculous healings. I believe the sacrament, temple endowment, work for the dead, and other ordinances have powerful meaning and supernatural efficacy. And as I once discussed at Sunstone, I believe that Mormonism has the power of the ancient mystery religions to take away the fear of death. But many of the same claims to being a well-integrated and meaningful system with supernatural support could be made about Catholicism. The Catholic Church can boast of the incorruptibles, 100 saints whose bodies never decomposed. The visions of the Virgin Mary were seen by thousands of people, many of them not Catholics, some even atheists. And there are actually photos of the Virgin Mary in the book Miracles by the great parapsychologist Scott Rogo, who also shows that cases of the Catholic stigmata cannot be explained psychologically. Having spent time in Islamic countries, I also believe that an angel revealed the Quran to the illiterate Muhammad and that the Sufi saints performed miracles. It would appear that otherworldly entities have varying agendas to promote certain religions. What kind of God would put us into this predicament in this world? If one recognizes that the God of this world could not be good by any mortal definition, what implications does this have for other aspects of LDS belief? Can one be a Gnostic Mormon? Given their respective histories of grand theological speculation, it would be appropriate to suggest some ways each path might contribute flexibility in its traditional position on key issues. To those who think I am forcing each to bend too far from its roots, I would say that I think this middle way is better than the alternatives. Let's first look at the sources of authority. If one is spiritually and intellectually honest, one cannot subscribe to every currently orthodox position of the LDS Church. The general authorities for more than a century have rewritten doctrine without claiming revelation for many changes or even acknowledging the contradictions between new and old dogmas. Anyone who has read line upon line can appreciate the viewpoint of Joseph and Brigham that deeper revelations come to people individually or as a group as they are ready. So the fundamentalist posture is less consistent than a more informed understanding that recognizes the changes, contradictions, and human elements in scripture and prophetic statements. As for the New Testament, even if one accepts it as accurate, despite its numerous errors and contradictions, and interprets it literally, it may be that Jesus recognized that if he told the truth about the Creator, he would have been immediately stoned to death. In any event, conservative Mormons and mainstream Christians are in no position to lecture those with different interpretations of the Bible about taking it seriously. They can't claim to follow Christ's highly inconvenient admonitions on divorce, treating lust the same as adultery, loving our enemies, separating from family members who are not believers, not judging others, forgiving 70 times 7, not resisting evil, giving up twice as much as you are sued for, amassing wealth, and so forth. Instead, we get a right-wing political theology which obsesses on abortion, gay marriage, the death penalty, equality for women, flag burning, birth control, stem cell research, government regulation, war, prayer in schools, guns and tax cuts, which I don't remember Jesus addressing at all in the New Testament. How different was his message as translated by the great biblical scholar James Robinson in the Gospel of Jesus? The Gnostic Cathars who actually followed such a gospel were, even by the account of their enemies, very Christ-like. In Since Cumorah, Hugh Nibley laid out the social message of the Book of Mormon that is exactly the opposite of the political program embraced by the majority in Utah. I think that Joseph and Brigham must be appalled that Mormons have gotten into bed culturally and politically with the very fundamentalists who think Mormonism is a satanic cult. If they can't get such obvious and basic scriptural messages right, then it's no wonder that LDS fundamentalists do not fully appreciate Joseph Smith. He was a much more complicated individual than Orthodoxy concedes, as everyone knows who has read Michael Quinn's 1998 version of Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview. Dr. Lance Owen's landmark article and dialogue about Joseph's use of the Kabbalah, and a paper presented at Sunstone on Joseph's connections to the Hermetic tradition, can be found at gnosis.org/ahp.htm and gnosis.org/jskabb1.htm. In last year's symposium, a panel led by Maxine Hanks, a scholar of both Gnostic and Mormon studies, showed how an understanding of esoteric philosophy can shed light on the prophet. Dr. Jess Grosbeck described him as a shamanic personality in one presentation, and another by Robert Berglund argued that some of what Joseph taught, such as the three heavens, could be called a Gnostic restoration. What all this suggests is that just as Paul said the law was a schoolmaster and that we see the truth through a glass darkly, the gospel in its currently taught form is a way station to the ultimate truth. That's not a wildly liberal position. It's one more consistent with all the evidence. On the issue of the atonement, Gnostic author Richard Smalley notes the value and limitations of the mainstream Christian formula. By accepting Christ, we allow his redemptive act to cancel out our sins. There is great truth, both spiritual and emotional, in this idea, and it provides a powerful answer to the problem of human guilt. But to believe that sin and redemption constitute the whole of the spiritual path puts too much focus on sin. At some point, we must realize that the human condition has more than a moral dimension. It also reflects a lack of insight. Our minds have become distorted by fixing on a mistaken view of reality. This brings us to the issue of what happens after death, and this ought to be the one area where the majority have some kind of consensus based on the many sources that we have. But unfortunately, this is where there is the greatest amount of confusion, which strikes me as fitting very well with the Jehovah of the Old Testament, who didn't say much about afterlife. Mormons are far too confident about their understanding of the hereafter, because you can amass evidence for almost any competing viewpoint about the afterlife. I do believe that one can accept physical resurrection and be a Gnostic, even though most Gnostics historically rejected it because they associated it with the material body. Certainly, Jesus could have taught what he did with or without a material body. And a Gnostic Mormon would have no reason to reject the concept of Christ resurrected appearing to the Nephites in the New World. I think it is even possible to believe in resurrection at the end of multiple mortal probations, otherwise known as reincarnation. This was supposedly one of Joseph's last private teachings, and most Gnostics believe in rebirth. Now, I'm an open-minded skeptic about this. I think that Scott Rogo in The Search for Yesterday provided better explanations from a paranormal standpoint, and I think it's fundamentally flawed because it multiplies the original mistake of sending us into the prison. The notion that we're eventually going to evolve and escape doesn't work. Instead, we're born into each life with a new set of dysfunction. There are also a lot of contradictions in the various reincarnation theories. If you buy into conventional theories, then by the 20th century, there should have been a lot of old souls, and instead, we had the most unprecedented disasters in history, 160 million people killed. On the other hand, I did read a book recently by Peter Novak called The Lost Secret of Death, in which he puts forth a very comprehensive idea that at some point after death, most people have their conscious mind and their unconscious separate, and the conscious mind reincarnates, which would explain why most people don't have memories of their prior births. And so I think his theory needs to be addressed by Mormons and others, although from the Gnostic viewpoint, this is perfectly plausible because Gnostics don't believe that personality is the important part of your being. Another innovative thinker about reincarnation was the great associate of Jung and one of the translators of the Nag Hammadi texts, Gilles Quispel, who suggested that reincarnation operated without karma. In other words, you would reincarnate because of attachment to the world, not in order to pay off some debt. Finally, if one accepts that the creator of the material world is evil, one might ask, what makes the true God good if she, he, or it doesn't intervene more aggressively in this world? Gnostic mythology depicts God as a being who is in some mysterious way alienated from the world, yet at the same time does care about us and sends messengers. I'm not sure that you can have a personal God who is also transcendent and limited in the ability to help. Rather than trying to explain why an absolute, if remote, God doesn't intervene more, maybe we should reconsider the merits of the finite God of Mormonism, but take the concept radically further. Perhaps the true God is even more limited than any religion realizes. The prophet Mani and the Cathars seem to me to have had the best solution to the level of suffering and evil in the world in their teaching that the Lord of Light and the Lord of Darkness are almost equal in power. I believe that the ultimate goal for Latter-day Saints should not be the peopling of new planets. Godhood is to be found in remembering that we are intimately connected with the true God, whose eternal divine spark we have within ourselves, awaiting to be wakened in order to free us from the chains of the God of this world. Thank you.
Well, Scott is ambitious. It's an ambitious project to compare Gnosticism and Mormonism. It's ambitious to even know or to try to know what either one of them is. It's difficult to know what Gnosticism is. It's difficult to know what Mormonism is. It's difficult to compare them. So the biggest problem that we face in answering his question, and he really deals with two huge areas. He deals with, in his presentation, comparing Gnosticism and Mormonism, and can one be a Gnostic and a Mormon? The biggest problem is trying to get a sense of a definite or a clear, definitive definition of a Gnostic or a Gnostic view. There is no agreement on Gnostic cosmology. Gnosticism can refer to a variety of heretical texts and movements in antiquity, non-canonical gospels, gospels included in the Nag Hammadi, others outside, apocryphal gospels, works like the Pista di Sophia, on and on and on. The Corpus Hermeticum is considered a Gnostic text. So scholars don't agree, and neither do practitioners. So that would be my first critique of Scott's, I think, excellent and energetic attempt to try to make sense of these two worldviews, and do they intersect, and where and how do they intersect. Scholars don't agree on what Gnosticism is, and Karen King says there were no Gnostics. In her work, she says Gnosticism is a category that was applied by scholars backward in time to try to describe a whole variety of heretical groups that seem to have some things in common, but the closer you look at the texts, all of the texts that have been described as Gnostic, and read between the lines, there are differences, profound differences. There are optimistic and pessimistic Gnostics. There are Hermetic Gnostics, Ophitic Gnostics. There are even Carpocratians who are a hedonist and who give Gnostics a bad name. So it's pretty hard to come up with a definitive description of what a Gnostic was. And yet this doesn't stop scholars or practitioners. Whether we're looking at Marvin Meyer or any of the scholars who've written about Gnosticism, or Bishop Stephen Heller or Lance Owens or whoever, they all want to propose two or three or four or five characteristics of what a Gnostic is. And Scott outlined some of those. I think that's a highly problematic task. I tend to agree with Karen King that they don't all agree. And I think if I were to identify one characteristic that all of those people who've been described as Gnostics might have, it would simply be the notion that there is a divine, a portion of the divine within each one of us, that we are offspring of God, and we carry a portion of that divine light within us, and that our task is to know that divinity and to bring it forth, let it unfold, bring forth what is within you, as Thomas said. Beyond that, I don't necessarily agree with most of the characterizations of Gnosticism. One major characterization that some people have made, which Scott paid a great deal of attention to, is the cosmology, the very complex cosmology, starting with a distant God, source of all creation, and then the further you get away from that source, the more flawed and distorted creation becomes, and that not very far down from that original source, we get the Demiurge, or Jehovah, who is a flawed creator of this world. That crops up in a number of Gnostic texts. I don't consider it a central feature of Gnosticism, personally. In my view, the central feature of Gnosticism is gnosis, to know the divine. The same can be said of Mormonism. Mormonism is incredibly complex. It was changing rapidly, doctrinally, theologically, cosmologically during the first 20 years, and since then it has evolved. It's hard to pinpoint exactly how Mormon Christology or materialism or embodiment is authoritatively set forth. We have a lot of, as with Gnosticism, a variety of viewpoints that compete, and members of a tradition participating and wrestling with all of these views. There's so much I could say, there's so little time. I'm going to mention that this comparison or looking at Mormonism and Gnosticism is I think an important area to explore. It's more problematic than simple. In many ways it's the arena of scholarship and comparative religious studies. And there have been some interesting attempts in the past. About 10 years ago in Dialogue, there was a lively debate about whether Mormonism was Gnostic, going back and forth on that issue. And it kind of got bogged down in what the central dichotomy or conflict seems to be. And Scott also took up this particular conflict, which is the conflict between materialism and anti-materialism, embodiment and non-embodiment. There's a tendency to see Gnosticism as ascetic, anti-materialist, anti-world, anti-body, and Mormonism as a materialistic religion that is about embodiment and the physical body. Again, I think that's an oversimplification. Gnosticism has more to do with embodiment and sexuality and sexual imagery than most people realize. And likewise, Mormonism has more ascetic and, I think, transcendent aspects than people have realized. So I don't think I think it's a mistake to characterize the difference between Gnosticism and Mormonism as boiled down to this sort of materialist, anti-materialist conflict. Just a couple more things. I know Nadine wants time for interaction with the audience. I think I'm going to just touch on a few, I think, common themes and some differences. Having problematized this whole endeavor and sort of implying that it's almost impossible to compare these two, I will now go ahead and offer a few thematic comparisons. You know, Gnostic themes do crop up in Mormonism, and they also crop up in Tolkien, Lord of the Rings, and they crop up in Star Wars and The Matrix. Why do Gnostic themes crop up in other traditions, literary works, and other religions? Jung would say that when individuals, when human beings are trying to apprehend the divine or the transcendent, they are receiving these truths in a form, an archetypal form, a pattern, and that these patterns and archetypes are common and that they crop up across cultures. In the Gnostic scriptures, we have a beautiful phrase describing this same situation. Truth comes not into the world naked. Truth is always dressed in some type of clothing, some type of archetype, some kind of form. Mormon and Gnostic cosmology, I think, do intersect at some interesting places. For starters, I think there are two places in Mormon scripture and theology that jump out at me as Gnostic. And I have to say, I've given a lot of thought to this over the last 10 years, having been involved in Gnostic studies and ritual and clergy work, and yet still trying to understand Mormonism throughout the course of my life as it unfolds. There are ways in which those two, they exist in two different paradigms. I mean, Gnosticism is a different worldview, a different paradigm. Mormonism is its own paradigm. Do these paradigms intersect at all? I think they do in certain places, but not wholly. In a number of ways, they are very separate, distinct paradigms. And Scott mentioned the issue of embodiment, physicality, the resurrection of the body. This is one big difference. In Gnosticism, the notion of salvation or redemption is the salvation of the soul, the light, the spirit, and the soul that surrounds it is what seeks redemption and reunion with the divine. Whereas in Mormonism, obviously the soul wants to be saved, but there's a tremendous focus on the salvation of the body with the soul. This is one place where the two paradigms don't connect. But I would say that whenever I read the King Follett Discourse and hear Joseph Smith in my mind talking about the co-equality of man and God, the fact that we are the offspring of God, we are co-equals with God, I hear an essential Gnostic message there. When I read the Doctrine and Covenants, I think it's section 110 or 88, or both of them, where Joseph talks about, Joseph creates a hierarchy of the in the nature of the human being, that our souls are the offspring of God, but prior to our souls being born, we exist as uncreated light, intelligence, or truth. That is Gnostic. The divine spark within each one of us, I think, has a perfect agreement with Joseph Smith's notion of the uncreated light, intelligence, or truth. And in fact, I see a symmetry there in Joseph's three-part, three-level aspect of the human being and the Gnostic, also the Jungian, also the Platonic, the notion of spirit, psyche, and body. The psyche is the soul, and the spirit and the body interact and create the psyche or the soul. And Joseph Smith is articulating light, intelligence, truth that is co-equal with God, which gives birth to a soul, which comes into a body. So I see a very similar three-level model there. A couple of other major common themes and then some differences, and then I think I'm out of time. The primacy of the personal, the inner experience. Both Gnosticism and Mormonism put the interior, spiritual, inner knowing first. At least theoretically. I know the church has moved away from that, but theoretically, a person's inner spiritual ability to know is supposed to be primary. Vision tradition. Gnostic tradition and Mormonism both participate in a tradition of vision. Seeing visions, having revelations. They're both very democratic. In fact, both Mormonism and Gnosticism, at least theologically, run into the difficulty of democracy in that Mormonism tried to create a religion that was truly democratic, a democracy of spiritual gifts. And of course, the church ran into problems with that early on. Gnosticism as well has struggled with the democracy of spirituality and how do we actually function as equals in a community. I see both Mormonism and Gnosticism struggling with that. They both share the core concept of the human as divine within. One of the most fascinating commonalities between Gnosticism and Mormonism is the textual basis. These are text-based religions, or traditions, I should say, that arise out of a text that was created to put forth a version of the story, a version of the story of creation, of cosmology, of Jesus, his life. So in Gnosticism, we have all of these texts that are competing versions of the story, and the same is true of Mormonism. In fact, there's an interesting parallel between the Book of Mormon as a kind of a Gnostic or apocryphal text, a text from ancient times buried in the ground in a strange language to come forth and tell another version, an alternative gospel, the Gnostic Gospel of Mormon, if you will. The same is true of the Pearl of Great Price. The Book of Moses is utterly apocryphal. If you look at the Book of Moses and compare it to the Apocrypha, those texts that emerged between the Old Testament and the New Testament, it's very similar in nature, not in content. I do not want to compare Mormon texts and Gnostic texts as being the same in content. They aren't. But in their coming forth, in the nature of the type of text and why the text is important, that is similar. In that there's an appeal to an ancient text that was buried that is giving yet another version of the story, and it's our version. You know, the Sethian Gnostics and the Valentinian Gnostics have their own text, their version. The Manichaean Gnostics have their own texts. The Cathars, you know, the Hermetics, on and on. The Mormons have their own version as well. And in that way, there's a kind of a vision, a text, a visionary text tradition. Let's see. I'm going to hit on just a couple of differences, and then I'm going to stop because I think we're almost out of time. It's important to mention the differences, particularly the notion of the Demiurge and Jehovah. Obviously, the view of Jehovah from the Gnostic and the Mormon are very different. Mormonism views Jehovah as having been Jesus Christ. Gnosticism, or what some people would call Gnostic, or one particular Gnostic idea would be that Jehovah was actually the flawed creator, the Demiurge. Very different views of Jehovah. Very different views of Christology. The Christology is quite different between Gnosticism and Mormonism. And again, put very simply, oversimplified, in Mormonism, Jesus Christ is resurrected physically, and his atonement saves us. In Gnosticism, Christ is the first offspring of the divine, of God, and Christ shows us how to fully reclaim our light. Christ is redeemed when the light is redeemed, and it's not a focus particularly on the body. It's not about redemption of the body, but of the spirit or the soul. And this becomes a problem for BYU professors who are looking at the Da Vinci Code and who are looking at Gnosticism right now, revisiting Gnostic texts. They're quite critical of Gnosticism, and they tend to reject Gnostic texts because of the difference in Christology. They see Gnosticism as rejecting the resurrection and rejecting the atonement. I don't think Gnosticism fully rejects those. I think we have different ways of describing these things, and our semantics get in the way more than anything else. But in fact, I think that Mormonism could benefit, and I agree with Scott, Mormonism could benefit by looking a little more deeply at the notion of the Gnostic Christ, because I think there are some intersections there that have yet to be explored. But currently, a number of BYU professors are denouncing Gnostic texts because of this problem that they see. Other differences: Mormonism privileges Peter and Paul, whereas Gnosticism privileges Mary Magdalene. That's a whole fascinating area that I've been trying to do some writing about why is Peter's apostleship and Paul's, especially Paul, who didn't even see Jesus, he saw a light. You know, why is their apostleship superior to that of Mary Magdalene, who is upheld as the chief, in some Gnostic texts, the chosen apostle, the one who knew the all, the one who received the fullness of the mysteries? That's an interesting tension between Gnosticism and Mormonism that I'm personally interested in. The availability of the feminine is much more prominent in Gnosticism. We have the equality of the Logos and Sophia. So the availability of the divine feminine in the cosmology, in the practice, and in personal relationship to Gnosticism is much more fulfilled, whereas Mormonism has yet to develop its feminist theology. The lack of orthodoxy and authority, Gnosticism doesn't appeal to orthodoxy or authority in the way that Mormonism does. Gnosticism accepts, appreciates, and understands myth and mythos, whereas Mormonism is still afraid of that word, myth. And yet, Mormonism and Gnosticism are both mythic structures. They are traditions of vision brought forth by visionaries who experienced the divine and brought back this vision, which is a mythos. And they have this in common, and yet Mormonism would not embrace that term. Last but not least, restoration versus continuation. Mormonism is very much founded on the notion of a complete apostasy by 300 AD, supposedly, and a restoration of the original Christianity. Again, this is a whole area that could be an entire talk itself. Gnosticism would say there was no apostasy. Gnostic experience continued. God did not break with his children, with us. Gnostic experience, vision, revelation continued through the years. Anyway, I think that's all I've got time to cover.
Thank you, Maxine. I think it was interesting to hear these two different perspectives on Gnosticism. We have very little time for questions, but if any of you have questions you'd like to address to our presenter or our responder, please come up to the microphone and do so. We have one.
It seems in many ways many of the things that were, quote, restored, different than Orthodox Christianity, can be found in Gnosticism, that things restored in Mormonism. What about the notion of the text we have being late Gnostic versus an early or proto-Gnostic early in Christianity, which is focused on individual revelation? And so now you start getting lots of different directions that Gnosticism takes, but what's the possibility that there's an early proto-Gnostic genuine Christianity that is being restored in Mormonism?
Maxine can address the scholarly issue, but I would say this. My main point is that although Gnosticism was theologically diverse, the principal issue is there was a creator of this world. Most religions other than impersonal Hinduism and Buddhism teach that God created our spirits, or at least put spirits in our bodies, and we have to account for that. If you believe that there is a spirit in the body that survives death, then who is responsible for putting that spirit in our bodies in this world? All the other issues, to my mind, are secondary to that. You have to have an explanation for that makes sense. It is very difficult to figure out what the true religion is, but I think that's a starting point. And I think if we are simply looking for a truth that we like, then there will be 1,000 choices, none of which has any more relative truth than the others.
Okay, Maxine, you can respond, and then I think our time is up.
Mm-hmm. I think that's an important question. You know, that's actually what led me to Gnosticism after I was excommunicated. I thought, where do I go from here? Well, if Mormonism is supposed to be the restoration of original Christianity, then I'm going to go take a look at original Christianity. And original Christianity is a misnomer. I mean, all we have are some sayings texts and reports or of sayings texts, supposedly Q and Thomas, and texts that were incorporated into the Gospel of Mark, indicating that Jesus was a teacher, sharing teachings. And as for people's experience of Jesus, those are reported in the Gospels, and yet they happen many years later. Mark, which is seen as the first gospel, isn't until 60, 70, 80. So we have no notion of any church. There's a report in the Gospel of Acts that a church emerges, but there's no notion of a church when Jesus is alive and teaching. He's a teacher, and he's teaching light and truth. And those who are able to receive it do. I think the closest we can get to a primitive or prototypical church is to look at those sayings texts, look at Q and look at Thomas, and see what they say. See what they say to you personally. Do the sayings still live? Do they activate a part of your uncreated light, intelligence, truth? And what do you do with that?
Thank you, Scott and Maxine, both of you. Appreciate your comments. Tapes of this session and other sessions will be available for sale.